Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm here, as always, with David Rubermill. And also joining us today, Sam Dasini, who covers the NBA draft for Sporting News, and he's also the host of the Game Theory podcast. Sam, how's it going?
I am excellent today, Wes. How are you doing?
Just fantastic. I'm really excited because I feel like we're going to learn something. You know, we don't really learn stuff from most of our guests, but I think you have stuff to teach us.
We'll see about that. I don't know if that's going to necessarily happen, but I'll see if I can at least try to, ready your viewers and listeners for what is now becoming a less and less exciting draft process for the Heat.
That's for sure. Yeah. But yeah, the bar has been set pretty low, so I'm sure you'll surpass it pretty easily. But you're right. As far as the draft is concerned, not as exciting a prospect as it was a couple of weeks ago before Miami went on their 9-game winning streak. All of a sudden, what seemed to be a surefire top three pick in the draft, not quite as secure. So we'll just have to make do. There are still plenty of options out there and a really deep draft. So let's just get right into it.
Can we talk real quick about just like, do we think that they're going to make the playoffs? Like, I think they have a real shot at making the playoffs, which is crazy.
I think so, too. I think, you know, obviously Milwaukee seems like they're struggling. They've lost 9 of their last 10. The Knicks are the Knicks. They're Knicksing all over the place. The Bulls could just as easily fall apart as they could go on a 5-10 game win streak themselves. Charlotte just made a deal today to acquire Miles Plumlee. That's really going to move the needle there for a team that's struggled much lately. So those are the teams right above them. Philadelphia, they could theoretically come back and win some games. Maybe Orlando makes a deal to strengthen their position. But honestly, at this point, Miami looks like the strongest of those bottom feeders that are hanging around the eighth seed. So I'm curious to see what happens.
What's crazy is that the Heat are 3 games out of the playoffs, and they're 3 games out of having a top 4 draft pick right now. They could go in any direction right now.
Yeah, I mean, the Heat could genuinely have anywhere from pick number 1 all the way down to pick number, 16, 15, probably 15 by the end of it. But that puts, Heat fans, I think, in a very difficult spot in terms of trying to assess, like, do you guys want to make the playoffs? Like, do you actually think it would be good for the organization to make the playoffs? Or do you think that you want to try and get this star? Should the organization sell? Should they, try and move a Goran Dragic, try and see what they can get for these 1-year players like Deion Waiters and James Johnson? It's a difficult calculus because the calculus for Miami is different than it is for other teams just because they're an actual free agent destination.
That's a good point. Yeah.
The last time the Heat were in this position, it was the year they drafted Justice Winslow at number 10, and they tried the entire year to make the playoffs, and then once it was kind of realization that they couldn't make it or they were mathematically out of it, they're like, "All right, we'll fake some injuries or whatever it might be and kind of get into that top 10 to make sure that they keep their own draft pick." Luckily, they have their draft pick regardless what happens this year, but given how what you were saying, Sam, they could have the first pick anywhere to the 15th pick. That puts the onus on the organization to really scout a big portion of this draft. They got to scout a lot, so that's where we're going to start right now. And we're going to cover everybody from the projected number 1 to some other guys on the fringe of the lottery. But overall, what are your thoughts on this draft class? Is it as deep as everybody says it is?
So I think that from 1 to 10, this is a draft that will hold up with any other in the last decade. Right. So you look at that 2008 draft, I think that, over the course of, the last 8 years or whatever, 9 years now, that's probably been the gold standard in terms of just, strength 1 to 10 in a draft. I mean, that's the one that saw Derrick Rose taken number one, Beasley number two, OJ Mayo, Russell Westbrook, Kevin Love, Gallinari, Eric Gordon, Brooke Lopez, like all those guys. And, you know, some of them worked out, some of them didn't, but the overall depth of that class was quite strong. I don't know that there's a future MVP in this draft class, but I do think that there are 10 players that you could easily see making an all-star game.
Now, I mean, is that the criteria for how you gauge what a deep draft is? You know, is it all-star caliber versus, say, something like, you know, potential superstar level player? Do you see anybody in this draft who might be able to fit that latter criteria of being a potential superstar, a piece of a team that you can potentially rebuild around?
Well, I certainly wouldn't rule out that possibility for Markelle Fultz and for even a few others. Like, I would not rule out that possibility. Fultz particularly, I think, has a unique offensive skill set that is very difficult to find in just any NBA prospect, let alone one who is under 18 and a half years old. He is able to get his own bucket. He's averaging 23 points a game on over a 55% true shooting percentage with absolutely nothing around him. Like, he has one other player that might get NBA looks, but beyond that, nothing around him that would even be an average quality starter in the Pac-12. And then he's a terrific passer, 34% assist rate versus a 13% turnover rate. That's kind of just a unique skill set that, like I said, like, it's incredibly difficult to find. Like, you saw D'Angelo Russell go number two overall to the Lakers in 2015, and Fultz's numbers essentially blow his out of the water. So it's tricky, and I think that we're going to see some, you know, maybe we'll see a little bit of regression. I don't think that, you know, he is this hyper crazy elite prospect, but he is a very, very good and a very worthy number one overall pick, I think.
I had a great opportunity to see him in person when Washington played Cal in Berkeley a couple weeks ago. And I've been watching him just because at the beginning of the year, I thought that he had a really good shot at getting him. I've been watching him a lot. And when I saw him in person, I was blown away just because of how fluid his movements are. And I don't think I'm a scout in any sense of the way, but I know I can look at a guy and be like, oh my gosh, that guy's really good. And he split a double team with a spin move. I mean, he had a step back. Like, he created a 3-point shot with a nasty step back that he missed the 3-pointer, but I've seen him make that 3-pointer a million times. I just think he's got a ton of moves. He seems to be really polished already. He's got go-to moves, and he's also really unselfish. And maybe, like you were saying, he doesn't have a lot of great teammates around him, but him even being unselfish in that environment, I think, is a really good sign. Do you agree?
So, you know, going back to the first part of your assessment there, I think you absolutely nailed it. He is uncommonly polished for an 18-year-old in terms of handle and in terms of not getting sped up. You know, you see all of these point guards that come into the NBA, like an Emmanuel Mudiay, I think, is kind of a perfect example of this. He looks sped up on the floor for Denver often. It's getting better. I think that it started to kind of click into place for him in December before he got hurt. But you see a guy like that who was noted for uncommon poise when he was a prospect, he still gets sped up. With Fultz, he never ever look sped up. And the fact that he has a real jump shot to fall back on is going to allow him, or it's going to allow defenses to not just get up straight on him at the point of attack. Mm-hmm. Like, he's going to actually have space to operate a little bit, because you have to leave him a little bit of space because he's, you know, fast and can blow by you, but you can't leave too much space because he can shoot. Like, he's in that awkward place where I think it's going to be difficult for players to guard him. The biggest thing, though, that goes along with that is he plays with a tremendous pace. And this is something that we'll talk about with Lonzo Ball as well, because I think Lonzo Ball does this same thing. He plays with a tremendous pace in that he knows exactly where he wants to get on the floor. He has the moves to get there, and he will get there pretty much regardless of the defense that is set up in front of him. And more than that, he has the move to react to the way the defense interacts with him on a certain play. He has a second move, a counter move, to where he's able to get to where he wants. That's very different. It's very rare for a point guard like Fultz to have that at 18 years old. And I think those are some of the skills that really kind of set him apart. And then the other thing I would note is just he has this uncommon creativity. And I think this goes to where the counter moves aspect of his game comes into play. He has this uncommon creativity. I talked to him last year at Hoop Summit. And, you know, he was just he wasn't messing around. He was shooting like 30-foot corner jumpers, like just for fun. And I asked him about like, why do you do stuff like that? And he was just like, you know, it's not that I'm ever going to be able to shoot that in a game, but I feel like the more like skill that I have, the more it will help me. And the more like unusual talents that I can accrue, the more that it will help me. And I think that that kind of gives an insight into his brain, right? Like he wants to be uncommon compared to other point guards. He wants to get you off balance and to kind of just have a creative mindset on the floor. And I think that shows in the way he handles the ball and in terms of his vision.
That sounds really impressive. I mean, I don't really get the opportunity to watch as much of Fultz as you know, some others do, especially West and all. But between hearing him talk and the description you just gave, he clearly sounds like the kind of player that you could build around or at least be a potential star. He sounds like a really exciting prospect. But from everything we've heard out of Miami, you know, we've heard that their interest lies heavily in Lonzo Ball as a playmaker facilitator. He's been scouted by the team. They've discussed him internally in the front office. There seems to be a high level of interest there. So you brought him up earlier. How do their games compare and contrast, and which one of them do you think might fit better for this Miami team?
Well, I will say this. I think that there isn't a team in the NBA right now that I would take Lonzo Ball over Markelle Fultz.
Okay.
I have Ball at number 5 on my board, but there are certain team situations where I can see Lonzo Ball fitting. Like I would like Lonzo Ball in Philadelphia, for instance. Like having a guy who is wholly unselfish in terms of the team concept, like Lonzo Ball, pairing him with a guy like Ben Simmons who's going to need the ball, and a guy like Joel Embiid who's going to need the ball. And then Ball's a really good shooter when he has his feet set toward the basket. I think that skill set would really fit with those guys, and being 6'6", 6'7"-ish, 6'8" wingspan, like they'd be very switchable. They'd be able to do a lot of different stuff. But having said that, Fultz is just kind of a different playmaker in that he is going to be able to take the game on himself. Whereas I think Lonzo is going to need a more, I don't want to say like maybe a cultivated team situation to what his skills are.
Sure.
Because what he's good at is he's good at fostering a wholly unselfish philosophy within a team. They see this guy who passes the ball like crazy and who, you know, most point guards that you see in the NBA that handle the ball, they don't pound the ball to death, a lot of them, but they pound the ball on the perimeter a lot, right? Like point guards, the traditional job of a point guard is to initiate offense, kind of wait for sets to happen off ball and then hand it off and get into the like full on action. Ball, he just headmans the ball and doesn't care if he sees it back again. If he headmans the ball and gets an open shot, he's happy. And that's this wholly unselfish attitude that he has. I mean, he has tremendous vision, first and foremost. He has the best vision of any prospect in this draft, certainly. He's big at 6'6", sees over defenses, has every pass in the book. There's kind of a difference between passing ability and vision. He has both passing ability and vision. In terms of his athleticism, he was noted when he was younger as an average athlete. I think that that kind of downplays him, and I think that another aspect that downplays him athletically is the fact that he's not a guy who's pounding the ball and just penetrating into the teeth of the defense regularly. He's more of a guy who's going to move the ball on the perimeter and just make sure that there's always, you know, motion happening around him and making sure his teammates are involved in the play. I think that that kind of underrates his athleticism in a way, because you watch him, he doesn't have like the best first step in the world, but he can get past this guy. He's big, he's rangy, he has good ball handling ability. You know, he can rise up for these dunks above the rim, especially off of the ball if you throw him an alley-oop on a baseline cut. He's a really, really good player. Where I would be concerned is he's not the best defender at the point of attack. He's just big and doesn't have great fundamentals. And, you know, while he does have like a, I think, a solid first step with the ball because he's a very strong ball handler and people have to respect the counter move, he's not necessarily this incredible lateral athlete either. So while he's very switchable at 6'6", he's going to have some issues in terms of that. But, you know, he's also a guy that I think the second question is he going to be able to shoot on the ball and off of the dribble? So he has this funky shot that I think everyone knows about where it comes from the left side of his body. What I think is going to happen once he gets to the NBA is I think really strong defenders are just going to shade him to the right. And I think it's going to be really difficult for him to bring that jump shot all the way around from the mid-range. Whenever you're going to the right, just think about the mechanics of it. You have the ball in your right hand. You have to go up for a mid-range jumper. You have to bring it all the way across to the left side of your body and find a way to shoot that like properly. It doesn't really add up in terms of becoming an efficient shot. Ways around that, you can develop floaters and stuff, but I think he has more questions basically than Fultz. I think Fultz you can throw into a lineup. Like, you know, today he'll be awful on defense in the NBA, but you could throw him into the lineup today and he'd get you 15 points probably. With Ball, I think it's a little bit more system-based, more situation-based.
A quick shout out to your the Game Theory podcast that you did with Jonathan Sharks of The Ringer. You guys did talk a lot about Fultz versus Ball, and I encourage our listeners to go check that one out from a few weeks ago. That was a really good one. But I know that you mentioned that you have Ball at number 5. You've got another point guard ahead of Ball, Dennis Smith Jr. I haven't gotten a chance to really watch him at all. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts. Take the floor. Go for it.
So, yeah, with Dennis Smith, I mean, you're just talking about the purest form of what Nate Duncan on the Dunked On Basketball podcast and obvious, you know, pseudo fame, if you want to call internet fame, fame, you know, and that's no slight at Nate. I think he does a great job. You know, what he calls a nuclear athlete. I mean, this guy has the quickest first step in college basketball. Probably he has the incredible ability at 6'2" with a 6'3" wingspan to finish in the 85th percentile among all players in half court situations around the rim because he just gets so high off of the ground. Like his head is at the rim every single time that he leaps. So there's that. There's the fact that he's a tremendous ball handler. He's developing as a shooter. He's up to 37% from beyond the arc now. That's great. There are a lot of skills with him to where you can see him developing into a top 5, top 3 level point guard if he hits his ceiling. And for me with him, it's pure ceiling based. I mean, this guy, I can see him becoming like, you know, maybe a top 20 point guard in the NBA, top 25 point guard in the NBA. Lonzo Ball, I think, is going to be a top 15 point guard in the NBA for sure. Like I just see that being his way. Like he's too smart, he's too fluid with the ball, his basketball IQ, like I said, is just off the charts. Dennis Smith has a little bit wider of a variance in terms of what his range could be, because I think his ceiling is, you know, legitimate top 3 point guard in the NBA, or he could be like a borderline starter in the NBA. The key with him is going to be, does he bring it every night? Does his body fill out a little bit more once he has to bang inside with some of these bigger rim protectors in the NBA? And is he going to be able to defend and be switchable on the perimeter defensively? I think there are a little bit of just a few concerns there just because of the height and wingspan. But overall, I mean, this guy is just a freak athlete who is going to get wherever he wants in the open floor in the NBA.
A lot of people like to compare prospects to NBA players, and I don't want to fall into that ditch, but if you could combine like parts of a couple of different NBA players, how would you describe Dennis Smith Jr.?
I mean, he kind of has early Eric Bledsoe athleticism. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, not necessarily Russell Westbrook athleticism, where it's just, you know, just a whirling dervish of insane motor plus elite of the elite athleticism, like maybe like one of the top 1% athletes in NBA history.
Right. Russell Westbrook face. Is. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's insane. I don't know how his face goes that way whenever he broke his face, but like it did. maybe like Eric Bledsoe, maybe that next level right below him, 6'1" 6'2" athlete. And the key with him versus Bledsoe is that the handle is so much better coming into the NBA. He is able to get into the lane whenever he wants. The jump shot is way better coming into the NBA. That's something Bledsoe's always been like a 33-ish percent three-point shooter. I think that Dennis Smith earlier in his career will be a little bit better than that at some point. So just in terms of athleticism, I think Bledsoe's kind of an interesting comp. But once you step back and kind of look at, you know, the rest of the skill set within him, I mean, it's tough because you see a guy like his game is so predicated on athleticism. You don't want to say like Kyle Lowry, for instance. Like Lowry is such a unique player because of his ridiculous motor and you know, crazy athleticism, or not crazy athleticism, more just like skill set that he's developed over the course of years and years. It's tough. It's really tough to find it. Maybe like an Isaiah Thomas in the way that he is able to, you know, find these, you know, these little creases in defenses and get there. IT is a really freaky athlete and he doesn't really get a whole lot of credit for it. He gets credit more for like his guile and intelligence of weaving in and out of areas. So no, it's tough to find an exact comp for Dennis Smith, I think.
Well, kudos for inserting the phrase whirling dervish into our podcast. It's pretty much, I'm pretty sure that's the first time it's ever been said. Also, I wanted to ask, because you mentioned Smith being able to use his athleticism to get, you know, a floating shot over rim protectors and stuff like that, but that's at the collegiate level. Don't you anticipate that there would be a greater level of difficulty trying to get that shot off as successfully or at such a high rate in the NBA, given, you know, the kind of length that you see in facing the kind of player like Rudy Gobert, et cetera, or even a Hassan Whiteside in Miami?
I absolutely do. I think that there's going to be a growth period for him for sure, just in terms of adjusting to what happens around him. Mm-hmm. But he's a really fluid athlete. He is, and by fluid, I mean, he has really good body control.
Sure.
The way that he rises, he's able to almost move his body in midair. Like, you know how there are some guys who, you know, it doesn't seem possible that once you get into the air, you can kind of move your body around. But some guys,
watch a guy like that all for 13 years in Dwayne Wade.
Exactly. Like, yeah, it's kind of a similar skill set with that. So I think that that mitigates some of it, but you're absolutely right. I think that the size is maybe the biggest concern outside of, you know, just making sure the effort level is always high. His effort level does wane in a way that, you know, frustrates me as a viewer sometimes.
I actually saw maybe this is somewhat of a bias considering the recent win streak, but I actually saw shades of Dion Waiters when I saw some film clips of Smith. So I don't know, maybe I'm way off base there, but I kind of saw some of that short height, you know, kind of that stocky build and kind of that incredible athletic ability, but you'd probably shoot that down completely. And again, I think we're pretty biased on this podcast about Waiters.
Well, I love Dion Waiters. I mean,
we're among friends. Great.
Excellent.
You know, I came up writing for a Cavaliers blog, so, and they took Waiters while I was writing for it. So I love Dion Waiters. I have written words about Dion Waiters since I was coming out of the womb as a, quote unquote blogger or whatever. What I will say is that Dennis Smith is on a whole nother plane athletically than Dion Waiters.
Okay.
Speaking of athletic players, Malik Monk of Kentucky, he's rising up draft boards. He was kind of regarded as just a pure three-point shooter, but I've seen some chatter about maybe him not just being that. I know you wrote about him for Vice today. It was a good piece that I encourage our listeners to go check out. But what's your overall take on Monk?
So, yeah, he is a wholly unique prospect, is basically what I wrote at Vice. He is very odd. Like, when was the last time you can remember a dude with a legitimate, like, 42-inch vertical leap that has been measured, you know, incredible speed, just a freak athlete that doesn't attack the rim ever? Like, can you remember a guy like that?
No, that's a top comp, yeah.
So, yeah, like, if you go through right now, according to Synergy, only 10% of his half-court shots come at the rim.
Wow.
among the, like, you know, smallish shooters that have been taken in the top 10 over the last little while, I mean, Stephen Curry is the closest. He took 17% of his shots at the rim his junior year. That's kind of a weird number, though, just because if you remember his junior year, there were defenses that were designed to literally just, like, sell out on him. They would triple team him. They would do whatever it took to take him out of the game. And it really clogged up the lane for him. And he didn't really get to the paint all that often. The key with Steph is, though, compared to Monk, Steph is an elite passer. He has elite vision. Monk doesn't really have that. And obviously, like, the athleticism is totally different. Like, he's a way better athlete than Stephen Curry is. Mm-hmm. But I would rather have the passer than the athlete in that scenario, just like to compare it. I mean, his 12.9 assist rate is one of the lower ones that you'll find for a 6'3" guard. So I don't really think he's going to be a point guard. I don't think his handle's good enough. I don't think that he gets to the paint enough. I don't think that he has good enough vision to be a point guard. So at that stage, you're talking about a 6'3" two guard offensively, who is in the midst of a historic shooting year. Like, we're not just talking like he is in the middle of a really good shooting year. He is having a historic shooting year. He's shooting better, according to Synergy, when he's guarded in catch and shoot situations versus when he's unguarded in catch and shoot situations. He's hitting at 1.5 points per shot whenever he's in catch and shoot situations and has a hand in his face. That's the second best of any college player in the last decade. Wow. Do you guys know who's number one? It's a player this year who is ahead of him.
No idea.
Bryce Alford at UCLA.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of funny.
Right.
But I love Bryce, so I wanted to make sure I got that in there.
He's got Lonzo Ball passing to him, too.
He does, but I mean, these are guarded catch and shoot jumpers. And I think part of it is that, you know, every pass from Lonzo Ball is directly in the shooting pocket. Mm-hmm. So I think that really helps guys, you know, just in terms of going up, and even when there's a hand in their face, they're able to deal with it. But going back to Monk, basically what it is, do we trust that he is a historic shooter? Because in high school, he hit like 32% of his three-pointers, according to Draft Express. Mm-hmm. And Draft Express has one of the wildest high school stat databases that you'll see that isn't public. So, like, whenever they say that there is a that, like, they have numbers on him, they have hundreds of attempts saying he is a 32% three-point shooter in high school. That's kind of concerning to me. I mean, the fact that he has taken such a leap in such a short time frame. So is it real, or is it, you know, like, has he genuinely improved, or is it like just a bit of a hot streak, a 20 game hot streak?
You did describe in the piece, which I echo Wes's sentiments, was a really great one. You mentioned that his mechanics seem very fluid and easily translatable to the next level at the NBA. Yep. Now, where do you have him placed as far as your big board is concerned? Is he still a top five pick for you?
I have him at 7 right now. Mm-hmm. You know, there are situations, again, like Philadelphia. If you told me Philadelphia took him at 3 because Markelle Fultz and Lonzo Ball were gone already, I would say, okay, that makes sense. I buy that. I would probably even have him at number 3 for the 76ers. That's part of, like, the difficulty of doing a draft big board, right? Sure. Like, you have to almost do it in a vacuum whenever teams themselves aren't drafting in a vacuum. They're drafting for a specific scheme. So if you're the Celtics, I think he should be like 9 or 10 on their board, probably, because they already have enough, you know, like, undersized scoring guards.
Sure.
Like, Avery Bradley's taken a step forward this year. Isaiah Thomas has gone nuclear. Like, everyone on their roster is capable of getting a bucket, and they don't really have a need offensively right now. They have a need inside. They need to rebound better, and they need to do that stuff. So I would have him like 9 or 10 on their board. But, you know, when you're doing a big board, you kind of have to cut differences like that. So with Monk, I have him at like number 7, and I think he has the greatest level of potential outcomes in terms of, like, I think he could genuinely be like a superstar. Like, if he's that good of a shooter, he might just, like, be the, you know, a 10-time All-Star who is unguardable in the NBA. Like, if he's that level of shooter, it's what it is, you know?
And he's able to come off screens really well and do all that stuff. It's like he's got all of, like, if you just need somebody to shoot three-pointers, he does all of the things that you want, right?
Yes, absolutely. But if he's not that level of shooter, the margin between being, like, a hyper-elite superstar and being, you know, sixth man microwave off the bench is razor thin. When you don't really bring anything, you know, translatable immediately to the NBA, to the table. So I think that makes it really difficult. Like, you could easily see him becoming that sixth man, or you could, like, a, you know, he's not really comparable to anyone, but, like, you know, a Lou Williams or something like that, or you know, the guy that I think he's most comparable to be honest, is J.R. Smith. Just because he has that, if you watch JR play, JR has that same elite level of athleticism that Malik Monk has, but he stays on the perimeter and doesn't really use it all that much to drive forward. He uses it to step back and shoot threes and kind of do that thing. Like, Malik Monk is going to be in a dunk contest and he's going to succeed in it, but he doesn't really show that off in games unless he's in the open floor.
But you did point out that J.R. Smith, you know, obviously has a height length advantage that Monk does not have.
Right. Like, J.R. Smith is 6'6 with a 6'9, 6'10 wingspan. Like, that's a totally different player than what Malik Monk is.
I love the idea of Monk for basically three reasons. If in this NBA, if you can shoot, and we're going to find out if he can shoot, right? Like, there's Kentucky's going to make the tournament. Chances are they're going to go pretty far in it. So there's going to be a big sample size there. So we'll find out, I assume, if this is just a streak or if he can really shoot it. And if that stroke is as pure as we're talking about, then that's translatable. I love that.
So you'll know that. I will add that you will have more of a sample. But 30 to 40 game samples in terms of three-point shooting just aren't that big. Even when you're taking 7 three-pointers a game. That's still only like 200, 300 attempts. And if you look at any research in terms of like when three-point shooting stabilizes, it tends to be around like 700 attempts, at least in terms of the NBA, that it stabilizes and that it like becomes a, you know, fact, basically, that this guy is this level of a three-point shooter. So I like Justice Winslow is kind of a perfect example of this to tie it into the Heat. Mm-hmm. Justice Winslow shot 41% from three in his year at Duke.
Right.
He played like 40 games or whatever. They went to the national title. I understand that obviously Malik Monk's already taken more threes than Justice Winslow took that year. But at the same time, it's just difficult to make assumptions in the one and done era where you only have a certain number of games.
Winslow hasn't even shot 700 attempts in the NBA yet. So what you're saying is that there's still a chance he's actually an elite shooter. Once that's stable. So the other reasons
I don't think that's true. But.
No, that's not what you're saying. Okay, I misread that. So the other reason I like Monk is okay. So that with the shooting, we'll find out hopefully after 700 attempts. He does have the athleticism that tends to translate in one way or another, or it helps. But he's also got like a really great name for a superstar, and that matters.
Yes.
That really matters. And I think he carries himself like a potential superstar, and those things are important.
Like the two syllable first name followed by the one syllable last name.
It's a winning formula.
I think that is the key. You know, like Markel Fultz, Malik Monk.
Right.
I mean,
and it's alliterative too. I mean, that's a big plus.
Dwayne Wade.
Yeah. Like this is the kind LeBron of like James. In-depth analysis you need. Yeah.
So Josh Jackson, Jason Tatum, Jonathan Isaac, all small forwards, technically all extremely different. My question to you is, do you have one ranked higher? And you know what? Look, you just explained the whole, I'm going to scrap all this stuff. You already mentioned how like the draft board in a vacuum is very different than a draft board in real life. If you're the Miami Heat building your draft board of small forwards, who do you, of these three guys, and maybe there's a wild card I'm not thinking of here, who do you have ranked?
Yeah, I mean, I have Josh Jackson at number two on my board. I think that in most situations, I would probably take Josh Jackson over the other guys. But in Miami's case, I think that it's actually more up in the air at the very least, because Josh Jackson and Justice Winslow have some pretty similar attributes. So if I was up that high and I had all three of those guys on my board, I think I'd probably take Jonathan Isaac. If I was the Heat at that stage, he's 6'10", 9 foot plus standing reach. He's hitting the three ball this year. I worry a little bit about the release being clean on that, but we'll see. He's still hitting it at a high rate. And, you know, like I said, it's very difficult to judge small sample sizes of shooters. That's why you more have to go off of mechanics and scouting at that stage and combine the two. He's also just a tremendous defensive playmaker. I think that Eric Spoelstra would work wonders with him defensively. He is the only basketball player in the last 9 or 8 years of college basketball to have a 64% true shooting rate, 25% defensive rebounding rate, 6% block rate, and 2.5% steal rate. What that stuff kind of tells you is that he's a highly efficient basketball player who's also a playmaker defensively. He's really going to help you, you know, he's going to build those stats. He's going to be productive. He's going to really help you create plays on both ends of the floor. And I think that's really helpful.
But, you know, obviously with him, he's got the length and everything else, but there's concerns about his size, his strength, because he's so lanky. Does he show the potential to continue to add muscle to that frame? Because he's going to need to, it just in order to defend players at the NBA level. Do you anticipate that'll be a problem for him, or will he, you know, be able to put on that necessary muscle in order to guard other comparably sized players?
I think that he'll be okay guarding threes. I think that he will need to put on weight to guard fours, certainly. Okay. I think that he'll get up to the 225, 230 range by the time he's, you know, 25 years old. I don't think that that's all that crazy to imagine once his body fills out and he gets onto a, you know, NBA consistent, you know, strength and conditioning program. Mm-hmm. What is most interesting to me is the fact that he has a 9 foot plus standing reach, which means like you could kind of almost see him playing some small ball center in some situations, which could be really fun in terms of just what his skill set is in terms of his ability to play on the ball. He can use screens sometimes. He can obviously set screens and roll. He's able to pop out for three pointers. I think it would really help your offense if you could almost play him at the five. I'm skeptical on that, obviously. I'm not like sold on it being able to happen, but there are some situations where I think that could be fun. I don't know that he'll ever be able to put on enough weight for that, though.
I've heard a lot of comparisons between Isaac and Kevin Durant. I think everybody's kind of looking for Kevin Durant. It was Brandon Ingram last year. And I think that was mostly offensively, but defensively, the way that the Warriors use Durant, I wouldn't say Jonathan Isaac can be Durant, but kind of what you're saying here, you could play him between the three and the five, and regardless of where you play him, he's going to give you some rim protection. That sounds like a Durant light defensively.
Yeah, I think that that's actually a pretty good comparison defensively, for sure. Just the way that he's able to kind of float from the three to the five and give some weak side rim protection really is what it is. I think that he could absolutely help in that capacity. I think that he will help a defense at some point in his career, no questions asked.
I love the idea of having Isaac and Winslow and just having Isaac at the four, Winslow at the three, and then eventually shifting down, playing one of those guys at center in for 4 or 5 minutes a game. I just want to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good idea.
Oh, good.
It seems like the top picks in the draft all seem to be guards, wing players, and sort, you know, things along that like. But, you know, obviously, I think for Miami, they're still looking to find a replacement for Chris Bosh. You know, they were obviously dependent on him for the previous six seasons, and you know, his absence has been a glaring one for the Heat this year. So, time to kind of shift gears a little bit. Now, we tended to lump bigs into one category, but there seems to be enough versatility among them. Do you have any that you think could be a top lottery pick and maybe somebody who might be able to fit well with Miami's currently constructed roster?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like true bigs, we're not going to say Jason Tatum and Jonathan Isaac, who I think will both play a fair share of the four. Right. Lauri Markkanen at Arizona is super interesting if you're Miami, I think. He fits perfectly with what Hassan Whiteside brings you. Right. He is a true 7-footer. He has probably the most utility on his jump shot. And what I mean when I say that is that he is able to get his shot off in the highest variety of ways. Like you see him, you know, handle the ball on in screen situations and pull up. You'll see him come off of screens, like running on the baseline on down screens and pin downs, and come up and like shoot threes and mid-range jumpers, and the shot doesn't change. He has like the most utility on his jump shot that I think I've ever seen for a 7-footer, like for a true 7-footer, which is incredible. I mean, he's shooting over 50% from three this year, which is wild. And I think that his question is obviously like defensive base. So with a guy like Hassan Whiteside back there, who for what I think that stats sometimes do kind of diminish what his defensive impact is in some ways. Like on one hand, like they really help him because he gets all of the blocks and, you know, he grabs all of the defensive rebounds. But if you look at on off numbers, they're a little bit more questionable in terms of like what his impact is. I think that just having a guy like that size back there really helps you in terms of rim protection. Absolutely. And for a 7-footer, Markkanen's not going to block you shots. He's not going to, you know, provide really any rim protection for you back there. He hasn't at all at Arizona this year, even though he's been playing more the four and sometimes even the three, just because they don't have any guards and they have Dušan Ristić, who's like a 7-foot center from Serbia. So I think that the pairing of Markkanen and Whiteside could really work in some ways. I also think that I would just be a little bit hesitant in some ways as well, just because, you know, we don't know exactly how effective Whiteside is as a defensive player yet. Some of the stats say he's really effective. Some of them say that he isn't effective at all. The eye test kind of gives you both sides of the question sometimes, right? Like he'll totally rotate and get out of position going for a dumbass block, and then he will sometimes just swat you into oblivion and start a break. So it's I'll be interested to see what they look like when they're a legitimate playoff contender with Whiteside inside.
I've watched a lot of Ivan Rabb in person, and I think I might be biased because I like him. I think he's like really competitive, and I've been kind of on the Rabb hype train. I want to know what you think of him and what you've seen watching him. He doesn't shoot at nearly as many threes. I don't know if he has that range, but he just seems to me to be a guy that is able to get some rebounds. He seems to know what he's doing on the floor, a good team player. Just kind of he's got like intangibles that I like. What do you think of Ivan Rabb?
Yeah, he's incredibly polished. He is a very smart basketball player who I think is going to help a team, maybe not from day one just because his body is so skinny, but he's going to help a team for sure. He's going to be an awesome rotation big man who might be like your fifth starter at some point. That absolutely has value, I think. That's why I have him as a top 20 pick. He also just might be the most boring draft prospect like in this draft.
Yeah,
I mean, like I was out here and saw him at USC, and like he dropped, I think, 17 and 21 or something like that.
Sounds
it was
right. Yeah,
like the most boring 17 and 21 that I've ever seen. Like I came away, I wasn't unimpressed, but I was just like, oh, that happened. Like, I guess he like was productive enough in the second half to make that happen. Or maybe it was UCLA he did that against, and then USC he was a little bit better. But like it was a weird game. And every time I see him, I just come away thinking that guy's going to play in the NBA for a decade. He's going to be a super smart player, and he might even play on a title team someday, just because those are the kind of guys that, you know, smart general managers look for. And he's going to go to a team, you know, somewhere between 15 and 25 probably, and he's going to get on a good team, and that's going to help. I just can't get excited about him. I'm not going to lie to you.
a couple more questions then. Look, we've talked about a bunch of these guys now, but true number one scorers and guys that can take a team to the next level, like a Durant, Currys, Westbrooks, LeBrons, these guys who can be like the number one scorer on a title-winning team. Do you see any of those guys potentially in this draft?
So, yeah, like, I think it's always tough to project franchise players, right? So, you know, the only two franchise players in the NBA where I think that like people predicted it at the time are probably LeBron James and Anthony Davis, right? Like maybe you could say Kevin Durant. I think that both the 1 and 2 in the 2007 draft were, you know, probably considered likely superstars, just given what we saw. But then again, you know, Michael Beasley that next year was also expected to be something similar. So, I mean, you look at around the NBA right now, like Russell Westbrook, for instance, he was considered like an overdraft at number 4 when Oklahoma City took him. He's become like a total monster. So I don't like to rule out anything like that. If you told me in 10 years that, you know, Markelle Fultz and Malik Monk became all time like elite level scorers, sure, I buy it. I wouldn't predict it. I think there's probably like an implied odds of like maybe, you know, 20% for Markelle Fultz that he gets to that level and 10% for Malik Monk. But it's certainly something that I don't rule out for anyone either.
So, all right. If you're now the Heat, we've gone on that win streak and everything like that. When we were trying to schedule this podcast in the first place, the Heat were still maybe like a top 5 pick. Now they're slated at the 10th pick overall. So let's just say then we've really covered a lot of the top guys now. Let's say that the Heat end up having the 10th pick overall in the draft. If you're Pat Riley, who are you just like crossing your fingers that slides down to you just personally?
I would probably hope that I would probably hope Markkanen falls to me at number 10. I don't think there's any chance that a guy like Malik Monk gets there. You know, De'Aaron Fox would be interesting, but I don't know that you want De'Aaron Fox with Justice Winslow. I think that'd be tough. Maybe Frank Ntilikina, who we haven't really talked about, point guard in France. He was the MVP of the U18. I think he'd be really interesting. Eric Spoelstra would figure out ways to make him work defensively. Like, he would be a total monster. He is just an awesome defensive player, 6 foot five with like a near 7 foot wingspan. But he's also a really solid point guard who, not like a crazy athlete, but a really good athlete. Is starting to shoot the ball a lot more. He's hit over 50% of his threes, I believe, at the U18, and everyone that's seen him recently loves the jump shot. So yeah, I think that he might be number one with Markkanen number two. And then, you know, it's tough once you get beyond that because, you know, it's so situationally based. And I think that there's a pretty clear drop off at number 10. In this class down to number 11, where you get guys like Miles Bridges and Justin Patton and stuff like that.
Well, I think this is packed of information. I love this podcast. This is a lot of fun. Appreciate you coming on, Sam. That was fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, anytime, guys, I am happy to help you guys out. And yeah, feel free to reach out.
And you can read Sam over at the Sporting News and listen to him on his podcast, the Game Theory Podcast, not just about the NBA draft, but college basketball in general. If you're watching a lot of college hoops, great podcast to check out. Make sure you subscribe to that. And make sure you subscribe to the show if you're not already. You can do that on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon, Sam.
All right. Thanks, Wes.
With the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.